welcome to Nature Backs Laugh and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This January 13th, 2015 edition of Nature Backs Laugh, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the one coming up shortly, is provided by Scottish teenager Rhiann Farrigan. Tonight's show, we have guest Katie Goodman, our Doomer of the Week, news beyond the mainstream, a climate update, and much, much more.
Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. We'll mention two stories. Mike, why don't you start us off?
Okay, this week my piece comes from newrepublic.com, and I actually posted it on my Facebook wall earlier in the week, and it's from January 7th, 2015. And the headline reads, "Why Black New Yorkers Like Me Are Celebrating the NYPD Work Slowdown." It's by Aaron Squire. For the second consecutive week, New York City police have virtually ceased writing tickets and arresting people for many nonviolent crimes on the order of a 90% drop from earlier in the year, or a year earlier. After perceived slight by the mayor, civil protests against police brutality and a murder of two police officers, the New York Police Department is fighting back by not doing its job, or rather, police appear to be using their resentment as an organizing incentive to skip certain non-essential cop duties. The police seem to be trying to teach a lesson to a city they feel doesn't adequately appreciate them. For New Yorkers who value fair policing, though, the slowdown is an occasion to celebrate. Many offenses police have tacitly declared legal are considered quality of life, or QOL, infractions. Those follow the broken window strategy, a policing philosophy that was widely discredited since its heyday during Giuliani's reign. QOL meets small transgressions with arrests and fines, a way it's thought to nip more substantial crimes in the bud. Perhaps because QOL policing grants cops nearly unlimited discretion in determining whom to sanction, its penalties fall disproportionately on people of color. Between 2001 and 2013, the New York Daily News found more than 80% of the 7.3 million people penalized for these infractions were Black or Latino. Mr. Squire continues, "To many of us from these communities, the past 2 weeks have amounted to a vacation from fear, surveillance, and punishment. Maybe this is what it's like. Maybe this is what it feels like not to be prejudged and seen as suspicious lawbreakers. Maybe this is a small taste of what it feels like to be white. Small penalties can precipitate risky acts when they are not as a portion of one's small family income. Here's what New York charges people for various minor offenses: $25 for an open container of alcohol, $115 for stopping or standing in a roadway or highway, $115 for standing or parking on a curb when not allowed, $250 for disorderly conduct, and $250 for noise disturbance. The Police Reform Organizing Project, a group that aims to end police abuses against vulnerable people in New York, has tallied some more recent crimes that led to arrests for people of color. Some of these crimes include occupying two seats on a mostly empty subway train, putting a foot on a subway seat, putting a backpack on a subway seat, using a loved one's transit pass to enter the subway, jaywalking, begging, riding a bicycle on a sidewalk. You get the idea. Now, QOL's disparities do not include driving while black, civil fortitude laws like confiscating property, stop and frisk be illegal, the vertical patrolling of housing projects, or the treatment of people of color receive once they are in the judicial system. My take, the police are here to protect and serve. This, of course, is one of the largest myths within the American story. It has always been, for those on the outside looking in, this really isn't news to them. The reality is the police are the guardians of an oppressive, violent state more commonly known as the United States. If you can't imagine a world without them, then your indoctrination is complete, my friend. Guy?
Also from January 7th, from Zero Hedge, comes a story titled, "Obama's Fed Board Appointee Was Previously Busted and Quit for Impropriety." The article starts with this lead: "Yesterday, to much fanfare, the White House blasted that it was Obama's desire to appoint Alan R. Landon, a Hawaiian community banker, to serve on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. To wit, President Obama said, Alan Landon has the proven experience, judgment, and deep knowledge of the financial system to serve at the Federal Reserve during this important time for our economy. He brings decades of leadership and expertise from various roles, particularly as a community banker. I'm confident that he will serve our country well. Apparently, what he also brings is the usual near-criminal cronyism and corruption that we have all grown to love and expect from every single Fed governor in recent history. Mr. Landon, who, according to Obama, quote, brings decades of leadership and expertise from various roles, end quote, really brings experience as an alleged failed embezzler. Alleged because he stepped down before the whole fiasco was further investigated by appropriate authorities, an escalation that may have ended up with a prison sentence for Landon. This is not the country most Americans believe it is. On to our most recent segment, which is called Real or Fake News. In it, we provide a headline, and you guess whether it's from the mainstream media or an organization such as The Onion. Today's headline from last Wednesday, January 8th, a science experiment landed this little girl in handcuffs. I'll run that by you again, just to make sure you have time to process it. A science experiment landed this little girl in handcuffs. The report is from Simon Black at Sovereign Man. In other words, it's a real headline describing an actual story. According to the article, the honored student was charged with creating a bomb in science class. She joined more than 260,000 youngsters reported to law enforcement officials in 2012, the last year for which data are available. Charges include throwing an eraser, chewing gum, and wearing too much perfume. It took 17 months of legal battles with help from the American Civil Liberties Union and thousands of petitions signed to support her case in order for this girl to get her record expunged. Of course, the threat of government punishment only rises with adulthood. Over the past 20 years, police have made more than a quarter of a billion arrests, so that now nearly one-third of the American population are on file in the FBI's master criminal database. What are these arrests even for? Murder, theft, and fraud only make up a minor proportion of this number. The rest are for a range of violations that are generally victimless and often absurd. This is now a country where collecting your own rainwater or feeding the homeless is a crime. I repeat myself, this is not the country most Americans believe it is. And I'd be remiss at this point if I didn't point out a line from philosopher Bertrand Russell. The secret of happiness is to face the fact that the world is horrible, horrible, horrible. Actually, I think the world is truly amazing. It's the people who are horrible, times three.
Now, if people would just take the NYPD's lead and maybe take a little time off, the police would have a little free time and save us some money.
Yes, there you go.
As listeners know by now, we offer brief opinion pieces. In Breaking Hopium, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue. We are joined this week by activist and writer Corey Morningstar. Corey, give us your brief take on the so-called green energy.
One must question how it is at all sensible to believe the solution is green energy when there have been zero attempts to curb our consumption to date. More is simply more. It is a fact that as all new renewable energies have come online, the end result has been more energy consumed. Perhaps one could argue for, or even believe, in 100% energy for 100% of the people if we had achieved massive cuts in our emissions consumption to date, or even if such a process was now being taken on with wartime mobilization efforts. But they have not and are not. No doubt one will argue that once the renewable infrastructure is in place, we will decommission all the fossil fuel plants. Yet what evidence is there that at any time we, the 1% creating 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions, will give up any energy or anything at all? If we haven't by now, and we certainly haven't, why would the future be any different? The illusion of a future that runs on clean, renewable energy by 2050 is allowing us to ignore and continue our rapacious consumption today. The 100% renewable campaign serves the same purpose as the so-called carbon budget, 30 more years to safely burn, and the zero emissions by 2050 goal. The carefully constructed phrases, marketed and normalized by the tentacles of empire, deliberately serve the illusion that we can keep consuming, keep burning, keep killing, keep growing as per usual. Today's emergency is kept locked away in the future. It is easy to promise zero in 2050, when by this time Earth will be likely uninhabitable with little to no life, human or otherwise. The slogan that appeared for the People's Climate March, 100% energy for the 100%, is nothing but a phrase that serves to alleviate guilt. A sign phrase based on reality would read, 100% energy for the 1 to 3%, the 1% being anyone who can afford to get on an airplane. Most all renewable energies will flow to the very same people who have always had the energy since the beginning of the industrialized revolution, the empire states, the annexed one states, the privileged few. As an example, the October 29, 2014 article, Solar Power Plant in Africa to Supply Europe, states that by 2018, a large solar plant in the Tunisian part of the Sahara Desert may start sending power to energy-hungry Western Europe. This is nothing new. This is the norm. This is imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. Beautiful Africa, the most resource-rich continent on Earth, ravaged and terrorized for her abundant wealth, her people purposely impoverished by colonial and imperial states. Consider that nearly 97% of the people on the planet that are without access to electricity live in sub-Saharan Africa and developing Asia. And then ask yourself why African solar is being transported to Europe, part of the 1% that already creates 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions. It's not what we need to add to the existing that should be our initial effort. Our initial effort focus should be on what we can live without, an extraordinarily massive amount less. The relinquishing of what we don't need is far more important than using what little remains of the Earth's natural resources to create additional infrastructure. The planet has already been raped and pillaged to the max. Climate science aside, humans are rapidly exhausting all Earth's natural resources. July 2002. Earth's population will be forced to colonize two planets within 50 years if natural resources continue to be exploited at the current rate, according to a report out this week. In a damning condemnation of Western society's high consumption levels, it adds that the extra planets, the equivalent size of Earth, will be required by the year 2050 as existing resources are exhausted. The report, based on scientific data from across the world, reveals that more than a third of the natural world has been destroyed by humans over the past three decades. Jump forward to October 2010. Our demand on natural resources has doubled since 1966, and we're using the equivalent of two planets' productive capacity to meet our annual demands. Is it any surprise we would rather focus all of our energies on how much more what more we need in order to be sustainable, an oxymoron if there ever was one, rather than focus on what we can cut out of our lives in an attempt to be sustainable starting today? Not because it will save us, but simply because it is the right thing to do. The fact that we do not do so and will not do so reveals much about our Western societies and ourselves, perhaps more than we can bear to look at. Is this critical? Consider the response by Administrator of NASA, Charles Bolden, speaking at the Humans to Mars Summit. If this species is to survive indefinitely, we need to become a multi-planet species. We need to go to Mars, and Mars is a stepping stone to other solar systems. Note that the quest to place greenhouses on and colonize Mars is well underway.
There's never been a time, there's never been a time, there's never been a time as fucked up as this. As fucked fucked up as this. I didn't fuck it up. You probably didn't fuck it up. But they, whoever they are, they fucked it up. Now it's fucked up. I can't unfuck it up. You probably can't unfuck it up. And if we're counting on them to unfuck it up, then we're all fucked. Okay, now here's where you come in. You don't have to sing. Just turn to the person next to you and ask them nicely, did you fuck it up? Go on, ask them. How about you? Did you fuck it up? Now sit back and look at them and say, because you look like someone who could have fucked it up. Now it's fucked up. Pick ourselves up off the floor and create a tone of camaraderie and ask, could you help unfuck it up? And then say, are you really so fucking busy you can't take one fucking minute to help unfuck it up? Then lose the righteous asshole attitude and take a breath and say, cause I'm willing to pick one thing to help unfuck it up. Won't you join me? Oh, that's better. Doesn't that feel better? Yeah, I'm feeling the love. The problem is that you just can't help feeling bitter that it's fucked up to begin with. You just go round and round like this. Just, okay, back with me now. I didn't fuck it up. Let it out. Come on. You know you feel it. You probably didn't fuck it up. You don't have to believe it. Just go with it for now. But that's right, shift the blame. They fucked it up. Now it's fucked up. That's right. Okay, yeah, you're clapping, but the problem is deep down inside, you're feeling depressed and hopeless, right? You're just gonna change the world. What the hell happened? Okay, I get it. We're gonna come together for this one. I need your help. We're going to fill this room up with love and inspiration, and it won't last past the time you leave here tonight, but everybody on this side, let's all unfuck it up. Okay, real loud and proud, let's all unfuck it up. Now you got to keep going without me when I leave you. Here we go. Let's all unfuck it up. Doesn't that feel good? Keep it rolling. Now over here. You have a special part. It's a little repetitive, but it's fucked, 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 it's fucked. Can you do that? It's fucked, it's fucked. Okay, middle, ready? I wanna be an unfucker. I wanna be an unfucker. That's right, it's fucked, it's fucked, it's fucked, it's fucked, it's fucked. Yeah, really loud. One more time with all your heart now.
I must say that's the best and most provocative introductory music we've ever used on this show.
Sorry.
This week, Katie Goodman, an award-winning musical comic, actress, author, speaker, creative coach, and social activist. She has been on Showtime's The Green Room with Paul Provenza, on current TV as a pundit, is a featured blogger for The Huffington Post, has contributed to O, the Oprah magazine, and is the author of Improvisation for the Spirit. She is the creator and headliner of Broad Comedy, an internationally touring satirical musical show that she and her husband, Soren Kissel, write and direct. Read about the group at broadcomedy.com. Her solo show is presently playing in New York City. Katie and Soren were nominated for the MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant for their extensive work in theater, and were also nominated for the Epic Award from the White House Project for Emerging Artists. Her music is available on iTunes, her book on Amazon, and her comedy music videos on YouTube. You can find her prolific work at katiegoodman.com. Katie makes her audiences laugh out loud, often in self-defense. Katie Goodman, thanks for joining us on the air today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
I discovered your work about 5 years ago, and I used your video clips when I was on speaking tours. In fact, I repeatedly used the one we just played. Our initial contact came by email when you wrote me in early 2012 to ask why and how I was using your music. And my first thought was, damn, copyright issues. But you were kind and generous with your time and your music, and you've continued to churn out some great social commentary during the subsequent three years. Why don't we start by having you give us a little background on all things Katie Goodman. When, why, and how did you turn to music as your life's work?
Well, actually, I think I didn't really turn to music. I'm an actor by training, music's only been a smaller part of it until recently. So I'm still mostly an actor and a comedy writer, but touring with the musical satire show. But I have always been in plays, and even when I was a little kid, directing and starring in my own things when I got comments at school for being bossy. So now I get to say, look, it led to a career. But and I'm a director, too. I still do a show called Broad Comedy with a troupe of women, and we do liberal, sort of feisty feminist, progressive issues. And I started doing solo songs in between numbers to help give the cast time to change and things like that. And then I sort of realized I loved doing that, and then I made all those songs into a show.
That's great. Well, and it pisses me off. I have many talents as well, but they're all hidden, even from me. So it's kind of irritates me when I hear about somebody who I think is a great musician, and it turns out that's sort of your second job. You know,
sorry, that's funny. For a while I was trained classically in opera, that's. You know, I never actually used that for good, only for evil. So I fear my mother's money was wasted on lessons, but did get a little training at one point.
I'm glad you mentioned Broad Comedy. We'll actually wrap this interview with a song from the comedy troupe, Broad Comedy.
Okay.
You tackle a variety of societal issues with your work. You've written and performed a few songs that deal with climate change, and that's one of the things we take on this show. What made you decide to tackle that particular issue as opposed to any of a thousand other critical?
Well, I think like you, what I know of you, it's obviously incredibly important and kind of trumps everything else in a way. Because if we sort of don't take care of this one, there's not going to be much else to take care of. And, I used to work for the World Game Institute, which was created by Buckminster Fuller when I was in college. And one of the things that we did was we created this big giant game called the World Game. And I think they even played it with the Senate at one point. But it's this huge game on a basketball court. And everybody's divided up into countries, and you have resources. And then you trade and you fight and you whatever things really happen in the world, and it was try to see how the world works. And there was a World Bank and a World Health Organization and all this stuff. And this was created, I think it was created even in the 70s or 80s, but this is what we were doing in the 90s. And I remember one of the things I learned from that was that population control sort of fixed everything. Every other issue came under that. And that was true for a long time. Now I think, obviously, population issues, explosion, is leading to the climate problems. So they're so totally interrelated. But so one of the things I got interested in terms of feminism was international family planning and things like that. And then you just sort of can't help but be, you know, concerned about what the number of people on the planet is doing to the planet. So they're just kind of all interlinked for me, and it's very hard to write about climate change and be funny about it. Especially, I mean, it's hard to write about anything that you feel super, super strongly about and not just be completely depressing. But I wrote one song. So there's one song, I think maybe the one you're thinking of, it's called It's All Gonna Be Okay. And we did it, it's on YouTube, and it's with a fake band of sort of these girls in go-go boots singing, you know, everything's gonna be fine. And then it lists all the things that are not fine. And it's funny, because we ended a show with it once, and I definitely walked off like, woof, that was a little, I mean, it had everybody screaming and clapping, but it was also just a little depressing. And I wrote one other song a long time ago. It's not even up on YouTube because it's just too depressing for me, but it's called Our Kids Are Gonna Kill Us. And and you know, obviously it's about what we've done for the next generation. So, but it was interesting because that one, like, I mean, we even changed it to be double speed, the tempo I'd originally done, in the hopes of perking it up. But it was, it's not like it was a fail, but it was just, you know, there's an edge with comedy. It's really hard to find that edge. And people are experimenting with all different issues in comedy. I mean, there's the first sort of rape jokes ever have been done publicly, you know, in the last couple of years, and that's horrible. And it's going terribly awry in some ways because it's just really hard to find the balance.
Hey, Katie, this is Mike.
Hi.
Hi. The balance, I was just thinking about that. I mean, how do you personally keep balance? Because, you know, you mentioned some things that you don't even necessarily like to put out there because they're too depressing. And is that because it's depressing to you or your audience or a little bit of both? And how do you make that balance personally?
I think I'm so similar to my audience, so it's sort of both. I'm willing to do something depressing if I think it'll help. But if it's, so like the thing about comedy that is really helpful, I think, is that by definition, when you're laughing at something, you are stepping back from it, right, in order to be able to look at it and laugh at it. So to me, I think it's a really important task to help people step back from something so that they can see it more clearly. In my case, wanting to inspire people to go out and try to do something about it and change it. Because my feeling is if people are just too depressed, then we kind of can't get out of bed and do anything about anything. So comedy, I feel it is like a, I mean, it sounds like high and mighty, but it's really kind of like a healing tool for the planet. And that's why I gravitated towards it. The last very serious play I did was like 18 years ago. And it was K2, and I remember I was on stage, and, like, basically my character leaves the other character there to die, and as I was crawling down this fake mountain, I remember thinking, like, I don't want to be doing plays like this. I'm just so sad. The audience is so sad, and it was totally meaningful, and I love going to see plays like that still to this day, and I love hearing that, you know, music that moves you, but I didn't want to just be immersed in it every single day because I couldn't handle it. And so that was when I kind of made the transition to comedy. And I feel like I'm serving better this way. It's just a better fit.
Now, you started your response to that question with your audience is just like you. So
yeah.
So your audiences are just like you. So your audiences are filled with talented, beautiful...
Yes. Thanks. I think what I mean is, and I don't even mean politically necessarily, because I've definitely had people come to shows where they said, oh my God, I have to tell you, I'm Republican, my parents are Republicans, but what you said, the reason I appreciate it was because it was smart and didn't take cheap shots. Now, I don't always get that comment because I do take cheap shots sometimes, but... that was really great to hear, and I had a really nice time chatting with this woman after a show. And I've had that happen a bunch of times. But, you know, I think for the most part, there was a while where I was worried I was, like, preaching the converted. They were all liberal, open-minded, you know, whatever. And then part of me was like, well, we're all going to just be attracted to what we're attracted to. So, like, I'm not, you know, I won't generally go hear, like, Jeff Foxworthy or, you know, the, what are they? I don't even remember what they're called, the like, redneck comedy tour. But I end up at clubs where I do hear, you know, conservative comedy occasionally. But I think I stopped being worried that I was preaching the converted and realized I was just speaking to the people who were already on the same plane and needed some, like, both inspiration and needed to be heard and needed someone else to say publicly what they're thinking and to be just like, oh, my God, someone understands me. Because when I go and I see somebody like that, I'm like, oh, thank God. And it just gives me, it's like maybe if some people go and hear a, you know, an inspiring climate change speaker, you go off and you're like, oh, good, okay, now I have more energy to work towards this, you know?
Absolutely. I don't know if I go see Guy for that, but sure.
I know, I was about to say that, and I was like, well, wait a minute. I haven't seen you yet, Guy, but from what I hear.
Yeah, mine's in the room, everybody, all right?
I don't know if people leave inspired. Anyway, so I'm assuming, you know, after a while, you have to run into some pushback once in a while. There's got to be, if you have conservative members or members who are not expecting the show that, you know, they show up for.
Oh, yeah. So our rule of thumb is a standing ovation and two couples leave in the middle. That's like a great show. Then you know you've done something right. And but the funny thing is, like, now that we're a little bit more well-known, people kind of know what they're getting into before they come, and also YouTube helps people, like, screen out what they do or don't want to see. But in the beginning, there was absolutely one person a night storming out, like, at some point.
Heckling?
What?
Have any hecklers ever?
Sometimes we get sort of drunk people heckling, but I'm not really a stand-up comic, and because I'm doing songs, people sort of know that I can't really respond because, like, either the accompaniment's going or the band's going or whatever. It's, like, really hard to stop and respond to a heckler in songs, so I don't have to deal with that much, which is good because I'm sort of intrinsically, like, I guess I never heckle because I feel so bad, although I get it. I get that it's, like, no, it gives them a chance to show what they can do. And I'm an improviser, too. It's not that. I don't know what it is. I just feel like it's so mean. But anyway.
Seriously.
But I'm just, see, this just shows you. I grew up in theater. I didn't come up in stand-up. I've just, like, come to it in the last 4 years. So in theater, like, you don't say stuff out loud. Like, that's just bad form, you know. So that's where my roots are. So, no, I'm not really... I don't heckle, and I don't really get heckled. Although I have to tell you, one time I had some friends of mine from college who graduated the same year as me, and I was doing this song called "These Are the Things I Can't Fucking Remember," and there's a whole line about it, what my 40-year-old brain just cannot remember. And from the back, I hear him yell, "42!" And I was, like, right in the middle of the song, and it, like, hadn't occurred to me that I was still singing that line and I wasn't 40 anymore. And it completely cracked me up, and I had to just, like, vamp on the piano for a minute while I kind of regained myself. But it was so unexpected. It was very funny. That's about the worst I get. But to answer your real question is that we get pushback, was your term, online. Endlessly. I mean, if you go and you look at, if you go to YouTube to my channel, Broad Comedy Channel, you can just type in my name, Katie Goodman, and you'll find it. And you go to the song, probably Gay, the homophobia song, and you just scroll down. Oh my God, there's thousands of comments on there that are mean and horrible, and people fighting with each other on there. And every now and then we jump on and we'll say something, trying to, like, you know, tone it down. And, I mean, not stop people from expressing themselves, but it's just god-awful. And that's, like, the worst one. And that's literally when that thing came out, it was, like, 10 a day. And now it's trickled off a little bit. But and then we have other songs, like we have a Tea Party parody called I Ain't Funding That Shit, about all the things they're not going to fund. And I would say that one's definitely, like, I'm not nice to the Tea Party, so I'm not that nice, but that one gets both like, I love it, and you're going to hell kind of comments back, you know. So there's a lot of pushback, but it's not so much in person, partially because people are wimpy, and partially because there isn't really a venue at a show. There's not really a way to do that as much these days. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with both of those songs. Those are certainly among your edgiest of songs.
Yeah.
So you're a mother, and you and Soren created and now own a summer theater camp. You do all this singing. You do this acting. You do this workshop. You're a multitasker. And so
yeah.
We're going to move to a song now and play right for a break here.
Okay.
Multitasking.
I can talk on the phone with my girls while I put my hair up in curls, while I clean up when the baby hurls, while I write a check to save endangered squirrels, while I wait, the squirrels aren't endangered, it's the Arctic foxes. Squirrels are in the attic called the exterminator. Save the foxes, kill the squirrels. Got it. Cause I'm multitasking, yeah. Cause I'm multitasking, yeah. Cause I'm multi-organizastic. I'm multitastic. I can plan the next day while I put the kids to bed, and I can shampoo and shave my legs. Though I once almost shaved my head, true story. I can get myself dressed while I dress my kids, cause there's no time to spare. So what if every now and then I end up in a pair of Scooby-Doo underwear? On any given night, you can find me up late. All at the same time, I can check my email, I paint my toes and masturbate. French. Cause I'm multitasking, yeah. Cause I'm multitasking. Multi-organizastic. I'm multitasking. Last night, during sex, I couldn't help it, but my mind was racing. My son had soccer the next day and I had his gear together, but there was still one thing that I was misplacing. I swear I was there, I really wasn't feigning. But suddenly I yelled, oh, 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 shin guards! That took some explaining. I can do it all. Efficiency is my middle name, in fact. I'm working on another song right now. I'll be Jewish for Christmas. Multitasking, yeah, cause I'm multitasking. Cause I'm, hey Tom, can you help that lady get a seat back there? Thanks. Cause I'm multitasking. Soren, I could use a little more monitor, but I think tasking. I'm a Ryan, is the light okay for the video? Okay. Girls, you ready for the next song?
Yeah.
Multitasking. Yeah.
Katie, are you gonna take the dog?
Oh shit, was that tonight?
Yeah, I have a school concert. Can you take him?
Oh, sure, can I? Multitasking. Yeah, cause I'm multitasking. Yeah.
Katie, it's time. Oh my God, where's Mike? He's out of town. You're my backup coach, right? Hop up. Right where I can see you? Here? Okay, yeah. You breathing? You breathe. You lie down. I'm crowding.
I'm crowding.
Oh, that's perfect.
That's a It's kind of a visual at the end there with the dog.
Yeah. Notice by now you swear a lot, and you're good at it. I'm quite jealous. So, where you know, you have children, you run this summer theater camp. Where's the line? You worked a lot with children.
Yes, the line, twain shall meet. we are super careful about, not bringing any of our things into the other. It's so funny. So many people think that my son has seen all my videos, and he's seen, like, one of them ever. He's in middle school, so it's like eventually he'll be able to see stuff, but not yet, no. I'm not sure if that's the question I answered.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we're rejoined by social critic extraordinary Katie Goodman.
The latest election results here in the United States produced a Republican majority in Congress, a majority that immediately set its sights on women and senior citizens. I'm sure children aren't far behind. As a social critic, you must be ecstatic. Have you developed a professional response yet?
I get to keep working, I guess. I remember when John Stewart was, like, when Obama got elected, and he kept making all these jokes about being, you know, basically the show was going to have to be going off the air, da 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 da. But unfortunately, I'd be happy to stop working on some of this stuff. But plenty of material still to come.
Right. And speaking of material, on the Facebook news feed right now, there are a list of three items that are said to be trending. I don't know what that means. But the list has these three items. I'm looking at it right now. It says, Eminem, rapper meets teen fan in Michigan who is reportedly stricken with cancer and has days to live. Number two, from Mount Laurel, New Jersey, husband of woman missing since December 31st is charged with her murder, police say. And number three, Aziz Ansari, comedian fires back at News Corp CEO Rupert Murdoch over jihadist cancer comment. Now, these are the most important issues facing the world of social media, which now includes nearly everybody in the industrialized world. I don't see where any of those items has any connection to my life at all.
That's interesting. Well, you know what's sort of interesting about the first two is that they are personal stories, right? So it was Eminem and the cancer kid, and what was the second one?
The second one was from Mount Laurel, New Jersey. The husband of a woman missing since December 31st is charged with her murder.
Oh, right. So, I mean, I think obviously the social media and a lot of things are, the goal is to just, not the goal, but part of what happens is people retweet and get interested in things that are distracting them from sort of the horrors. Although that second one is sort of, they're both sort of horrors. They're all kind of horrors in a different way, but they're, I feel like they're, look, the first one is like, look, this great guy, he went and made this kid's day. That's like happy, something you can do about something, right? The second one is something that would never happen to you, right? Like, generally, probably your family doesn't have mass murders, but...
Not that we talk
about. So we talk about it. So it's outside of us. And the third one's a little bit more complicated. I didn't read what Aziz said, but he's a pretty interesting comedian. But he, that's trending. Now, that does have something to do with your life, because you're somebody who speaks out on the radio and has opinions, right? And so we're all talking about, I mean, it certainly has something to do with my life in terms of being a satirist and Charlie Hebdo, right?
Yeah,
so that's, I'm imagining what...
Typical American, these are just more celebrity stories that, as you pointed out, are distractions from what I would consider
right. Significant
issues of the day. I mean, there's a lot of things that the news can be reporting about.
Yeah. Now, that's been the case, though. I mean, if you look, I'm not a historian, obviously, but if you look back, you can sometimes when I've looked at old newspapers and magazines and things like that, that's not a new phenomenon, right? Oh. It's just so much more massive because of social media as opposed to newspapers. But everybody's always been interested in larger than life and things happening outside of their family. I think one thing that's really sort of interesting about social media, two things. One is that it absolutely can help, you know, and I've seen, I mean, I've been in many, many protests where the social media, first of all, you couldn't even get a tweet out because so many were going on. It's like, please try again later. But where, and certainly there's ones happening overseas where terrible things are happening and people are letting people know. And that's phenomenal. That's incredible use of, like, democratic tools. So certainly as, like, a activist, I'm very interested in that, you know. But I also think it just does indicate how out of control we feel. And when you start with our own lives, and that's why we're paying attention to some of these other things that are sensationalist, and then also outside of our, so much is outside of our realm of being able to affect change. And that's horribly, horribly depressing. So it's pessimistic, you know, hopeless, all the, like, classic depression kind of stuff. So that is the thing that we are all up against with climate change issues, you know, feeling hopeless and feeling, and I know you get into this, but certainly my goal is to make people not feel hopeless, or at least, like, a little re-energized through comedy and having a collective experience, like theater and comedy are a collective experience. And comedy in some ways more than drama, because you hear other people laughing. In drama, you don't hear the response, right? So people just walk out of shows. I mean, obviously not just my show, but they walk out of movies and shows and everything just feeling kind of re-energized. And that's just so vital to a community that's facing too much information. And at the risk of, sorry, going on and on and on, one other thing that I think is really interesting right now, the amount of global awareness that we all have, and climate change being the biggest, that we need to track. But I don't know if you've seen some of these stories and studies where, you know, humans are only able to actually process information and empathy towards, like, 140 people. Like, there's, I'm totally screwing this up, the study, but there's something like that. And, of course, it's evolutionarily so that we can worry about our tribe, right? And so when you go out, side of that, and the number just becomes exponentially so much bigger, it's really, they say, really impossible to care and understand, and you just get overwhelmed immediately.
Right. That's, so Dunbar's number indicates that a tribe no larger than 250 people or so.
Yeah. So okay, what is it? 250? Jeez, that still seems big. But yeah,
150.
It was funny. Yeah. We actually sent out, like, a little Christmas email funny video that our family did, and we were just sending it to people just by our memory of who we wanted to send it to, and it was literally, like, 140 friends and family that we, and I was like, God, that's a lot of people, you know, but at the same time, that was it. After that number, we were, like, done, and I sort of remembered that being the number, but I'm clearly wrong, but whatever it is. You know, I think that's why social media is, I think it makes us sort of more depressed in a lot of ways, because we're so overwhelmed. So then we go and pick something like what you just said is trending, because you can picture it and it's manageable or something. I don't know. I don't really pay attention to those stories generally, though. But now you made me want to go look up the Aziz one, because now I'm interested.
More depressed media, that's a...
Do you spend a fair amount of time on social media?
Do I spend time on social media? Not nearly as much as people in my field, because I just kind of can't stand it. It feels like sometimes on Facebook I feel like we have really good, interesting, real conversations with fans and stuff or friends, and that's kind of cool. And on Twitter, too. I've actually met some amazing people on Twitter, which is pretty neat. But I do not at all spend all day. I'm lucky if I shoot out three things a day, because I just feel like it doesn't feel like it's like a human interaction, even though, I don't know, I'm very conflicted about it.
You live out in the middle of nowhere, like the two of us.
Social media is real. That's your whole family.
Do you mean Montana?
Close.
No, I used to live in Montana. I thought that's what you were referencing.
No. We live in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico.
Oh, yeah. No, I used to live in the middle of nowhere in Montana for 12 years. Not the middle of nowhere, it's Bozeman, but it was like, I mean, it was very, that's the only reason I could even have a career is because of social media and live out somewhere like that. But no, now I'm in New York, so.
Going back to your original career, how you got started in theater, did you have mentors? Do you have mentors today? Who do you follow? Who do you look up to? And where do you get your material? Where does all that come from?
Yeah. Well, I definitely have mentors. some of them are from long, long ago. They're just all so different and specific. You know, like, I mean, I grew up listening to Tom Lehrer, who is a satirist, piano player and a professor at Harvard, and he, that was like all there was back in the day, you know. So there's a lot of musicians and things like that. But I'm less of a music person than I am as an actor. So, of course, you know, all the ones you'd think, Meryl Streep, everybody like that. But in terms of like comedy writers, I'm a little bit all over the map with that. I tend to like things that are a little bit quirkier. I watch shows like Enlightenment with Lauren Dern, and I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I don't watch Friends and Seinfeld and stuff like that, and I never have. I always watch things that are a little bit trickier, more complicated. And I think that's because I'm basically, again, a theater person. I want, like, a really rich story as opposed to stand-up jokes. But that's just my where I gravitate.
So
I mean, there's other mentors though, but they're like, you know, some political women who I've loved and, you know, either worked for their campaigns or tried to help. I do fundraisers for Planned Parenthood and stuff like that. So there's a lot of people in those worlds who are really political and they're activists that I adore. There's one female comic who I love, and her name is Nagin Farsad, and she's become a friend, and I definitely recommend checking her out. She's one of the funniest feminist Islamic comedians I've ever met. So there's people like that I've learned a lot from.
I'm sure she's got an endless amount of material.
So. Yeah, she's great. She has a movie called The Muslims Are Coming, and it's hilarious. It's a really good one to watch right now, actually.
Wow.
Whoa. So in 1 minute or less, we need to wrap here. What's next?
Yep.
What have you been working on lately? Where are you headed with your music?
We wrote a musical. My husband's my co-writer, and we wrote a musical called Catapult Love about a woman who is serially dating narcissist after narcissist. And we wrote it with, we were asked to write it with Tom Tolles, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist of the Washington Post. And we all just fell in love and with each other's work, and we just showcased it this fall. So now we're hoping to develop it and get it off Broadway at some point. And I'm just going to be acting in film, TV, videos, whatever's coming up next. We'll see.
Awesome. Great. Thank you, Katie Goodman, for spending
time. Yeah, thanks, you guys.
Progressive Radio Network. This is Mike Slavin, Guy McPherson. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thanks, Katie.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Have fun.
Yeah, let's wrap that with a final song from Katie Goodman and her comedy group, Broad Comedy. It's All Gonna Be Okay.
Production at 88 million barrels a day. But when the oil industry
110.
Holy cow, and it's a pain. It's all gonna be okay. It's all gonna be okay. Cause we're still at 88 today. We'll have another billion humans by the year 2025. And we'll need a trillion cubic meters of water that we don't have. Cause some guy from some cool TED talk will invent something in a snap, or just use all of that brand new water from the melting polar ice caps. Besides the places where most of them will be, haven't had much water all along. Just now 9 children died of diarrhea in the time it took to sing this song. But it's okay, it's all gonna be okay. Black Rhino is a few and just fine. Oh, he's a good friend of mine. Oh, used to be in decline. Okay.
Oh, wait, he's dead. Come on.
Yeah, they're gone.
Extinct?
Yep.
No more Black Rhino? Look! A tambourine!
See, it's okay. It's all gone. Okay, it's all gonna be okay.
Never seen a rhino anyway. I'm sure they'll clone one with his DNA.
Cause it's all gonna be okay,
everybody.
It's all gonna be okay.
Come on now.
It's all gonna be okay.
Global warming.
It's all gonna be okay.
Sex trafficking.
It's all gonna be okay.
Plastic in the ocean.
It's all gonna be okay.
Destroying rainforests.
It's all gonna be okay.
Drones killing civilians.
It's all gonna be okay.
Fracking.
It's all gonna be okay.
Hey, come with us. Let's all go watch TV.
Come on, let's all go and watch TV. And watch TV. And watch TV.
Each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo but also provides insightful and useful information. Our doomer for this week is Dylan Wilson. Dylan was responding to this question posted on the page of the Facebook group Whistling in the Dark. The question is, anybody have any positive thoughts for the day? The question and the response were posted last Wednesday, January 7th. Dylan Wilson responded with this dose of reality, quote, I'm grateful that I'm not immortal and thankful that there is a built-in end to this grotesque pantomime called industrial civilization. Jonathan Swift poignantly illustrated the horrors of immortality in his classic work of social criticism, Gulliver's Travels. That was nearly 3 centuries ago. Dylan's response from Great Britain puts him well ahead of the crowd on this side of the pond.
Thank you, Dylan. Guy, what do we have for a climate update?
We have 5 important news bits about climate change this week. First, another self-reinforcing feedback loop has been triggered. This is number 47 for those of you keeping score at home. Increased temperature of the ocean contributes to reduced storage of carbon dioxide. So as the ocean warms, it serves as less of a battery for carbon dioxide. Quote, results suggest that predicted future increases in ocean temperature will result in reduced CO2 storage by the ocean. This according to a paper in the January 5th online issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Number 2, we have a paper co-authored by Jennifer Francis in the January 6th, 2015 issue of Environmental Research Letters, and it concludes with this line in the abstract. These results suggest that as the Arctic continues to warm faster than elsewhere in response to rising greenhouse gas concentrations, the frequency of extreme weather events caused by persistent jet stream patterns will increase. Third item, a paper published, it's actually currently in press with the journal Progress in Physical Geography, concludes its abstract with this line, quote, all the evidence indicates that most long-term climate change occurs in sudden jumps rather than in incremental changes, end quote. Better late than never to the party of abrupt climate change, I suppose. Conservation biologist Paul Ehrlich concludes near-term human extinction during an interview with MSNBC on January 10th, just a few days ago. He also absurdly hails the glories of civilization, thus failing to recognize the horrors it brings. But he's starting to catch up with the reality of abrupt climate change, and you should have seen the news anchor who was completely freaked out by this news from Paul Ehrlich. Finally, Paul Beckwith is quoted by Darja Mayo in today's issue of Truthout, quote, it is my view that our climate system is in early stages of abrupt climate change that, unchecked, will lead to a temperature rise of 5 to 6 degrees Celsius within a decade or two, end quote. Unchecked, the only proposed solutions involve geoengineering, which, according to the journal Nature, will actually make matters worse. But I'm not sure checking is a good idea.
Where's that tambourine?
Yeah, where is that tambourine when we need it?
Everything's going to be okay. That about wraps it up this week. Thanks to our guest, Katie Goodman. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like to address on the show. Please continue to follow Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening, and if you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week and to Afrizin and Rhianne Ferrigan for the music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Gonna get you.